Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz. Jeff Bennett is away. On the NewsHour tonight, a grim milestone in Gaza, with the death toll surpassing 20,000 less than 3 months into the war. A recording surfaces of former President Trump pressuring Michigan election officials to not certify the 2020 vote, what it means for his 2024 campaign and the nation's democracy. And ever wondered where lost luggage ends up? During the busy travel season, we visit the store that sells all the unclaimed baggage.
What our guests have in common is they love the thrill of the hunt. I mean, you never know what you're going to find.
Welcome to the NewsHour. The United Nations Security Council came together today to approve a resolution calling for more humanitarian aid to flow into Gaza after a week of delays. The U.S. abstained from the vote, which did not demand a ceasefire. In the meantime, American officials are saying Iran was deeply involved in the planning of attacks against commercial shipping vessels in the Red Sea.
Bodies and burials overwhelm Gaza. Officials of the Hamas-run health ministry say the death toll has passed 20,000. After another airstrike, Anwar Dahir buried the next generations of his family.
My daughter, her husband, this is my grandson. He was a baby, 4 months old.
Those lucky enough to survive still face a bleak fate. The few remaining hospitals don't have enough staff or supplies for meaningful treatment. This school has been turned into a field hospital.
We can't do anything but gauze and disinfectant. We don't have anything else. We call on everyone, the whole world, to support us in providing medical equipment, providing medicine, lifting the siege on Gaza.
Staff at the Al Zawaida Clinic provide what care they can, but without enough early childhood vaccines, these children will be far more susceptible to illnesses like polio or measles. Lama Al-Afesh is a nurse.
We have a shortage of childhood vaccinations, especially those who are newborn babies aged 1 and 2 months.
Clinical psychologist Walid Omar Hamdan said he worries about the long-term consequences, mental as well as physical.
Things were fragile somehow before the war, and during this war, things became even worse. The number of psychiatric cases among children, adolescents, and adults has increased significantly.
But even with the best medical care, Gazans can't recover without food and water. International aid organizations estimate that 500,000 people are starving in Gaza and say the situation could collapse into famine.
Even if we provide food, but we have many problems, like we have no access to gas, so we go to streets to gather some woods to burn the fire and cook the food. And also a huge number of families, and we don't have food that is enough for them.
Aid trickles in through the Rafah crossing and the newly opened Kerem Shalom crossing. But once inside Gaza, aid workers struggle to reach those who need it. Israeli officials say there is no shortage.
In terms of food, the reserves in Gaza Strip are sufficient for the near term.
The result of the vote is as follows.
After many delays, the United Nations Security Council approved a resolution calling for much more humanitarian aid for Gaza.
Abstentions?
The United States and Russia abstained after a U.S. veto of a Russian amendment calling
ultimately,
for a ceasefire.
While we are encouraged that the Council spoke out on this humanitarian crisis, we're deeply disappointed, appalled actually, that once again, the Council was not able to condemn Hamas's horrific terrorist attack on October 7th.
Today, a southern Israel kibbutz said it had determined that one of its residents, an American Israeli citizen, had been killed in the initial Hamas attack October 7th. Kibbutz Nir Oz said Hamas took 73-year-old Gad Hagi's body to Gaza. In a statement, President Biden said, "I reaffirm the pledge we have made to all the families of those still held hostage. We will not stop working to bring them home." With American support, the Israeli offensive pushes forward, determined to complete its mission. As Christmas nears, the region prepares for a different kind of holiday. Near Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity, revered by Christians as the traditional birthplace of Christ, rubble takes the place of Christmas lights, a gesture of solidarity with Gaza.
Art is a message. Whether it is a painting or art through rocks, it's a message. And this message is that people can see the real scene, that Christmas comes during war and hardship.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
In the day's other headlines, the Supreme Court won't expedite a ruling on former President Trump's claim of presidential immunity for his attempt to overturn the 2020 election. Special counsel Jack Smith had requested the Supreme Court fast-track its decision so the trial could begin in March, ahead of next year's presidential election. The issue will now be left to the U.S. Court of Appeals. It could still work its way up to the Supreme Court eventually. Wisconsin Supreme Court today overturned the state's Republican-drawn legislative maps. They ordered new district boundary lines be drawn ahead of the 2024 election. Democrats had argued that the maps were unconstitutional because they weren't contiguous and gave Republicans an unfair advantage. President Biden issued pardons for thousands of people convicted of using and possessing marijuana on federal lands and in the District of Columbia. It expands on a similar move he made last year, part of his pledge for criminal justice reform. Mr. Biden also granted clemency to 11 people serving, quote, disproportionately long sentences for nonviolent drug offenses. A fierce Pacific storm unleashed downpours and strong winds on the deserts of Southern California today. The same system inundated the Los Angeles area yesterday, triggering flooding and road closures and wreaking havoc on holiday travel plans. The storm is expected to move into southwest Arizona and taper off. The Czech Republic is reeling after its deadliest shooting in history. A gunman opened fire yesterday at a university in Prague, fatally shooting 14 people before killing himself. Dozens more were wounded. Mourners gathered today at a makeshift memorial near the scene of the attack. They lit candles and reflected on the shooting's impact.
What happened yesterday was, as a Czech especially, in the city center, hearing, I was on the other side of the river and hearing gunshots, pops, not knowing what's going on, and then a flurry of police cars passing by was absolutely surreal for me as a Czech.
Authorities say the shooter was a student at the school, but they're still trying to piece together a motive. They believe he killed his father beforehand and possibly two other people last week. In Ukraine, Russian drones pounded buildings in the capital overnight and regions farther south. The strikes tore through the top floors of an apartment complex in Kyiv. Officials say more than two dozen drones flew towards the city, though most were shot down. More were intercepted in Odessa and Mykolaiv, where debris damaged a granary and other port facilities. Back in this country, trading was light on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 18 points to close at 37,386. The Nasdaq rose 29 points, and the S&P 500 added 8. And nothing spreads holiday cheer quite like a winning ticket in Spain's annual Christmas lottery. In Madrid, crowds dressed up for the big draw. This year's total prize pot reached a record-breaking $2.8 billion. The top winning ticket holders took home $440,000 apiece. Confetti fell and champagne flowed as the lucky numbers were announced. The Spanish Christmas tradition dates all the way back to 1812. Still to come on the NewsHour, David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on this week's political headlines. A review of films that stood out in a year plagued by the writers and actors' strikes. And U.S. troops spread some Christmas joy in the form of a song.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
A report out of Michigan further pulls back the curtain on former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The Detroit News listened to a partial recording of a phone call between Trump, Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, and two local election officials from late November of that year. In it, Trump and McDaniel can reportedly be heard pressuring the Republican chair and another member of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers not to certify the election results there, despite no evidence of fraud. William Brangham has been tracking this story today and joins me now. William, it's good to see you.
Hi.
So what exactly were President Trump and Ronna McDaniel trying to do on that call, and what kind of impact could it have had on the larger election?
Here's what we know. Joe Biden won Michigan by about 154,000 votes. But at the time of this call, Michigan had not certified those votes. And so imagine you're these two local elections officials, and the phone rings, and it's the president of the United States and the chairman of the Republican National Committee, and they're saying, don't certify those results. It's crooked. We'll send lawyers. There's been rigging going on here. Just imagine the power dynamic difference there, where the president is calling, asking you to do this. I mean, as we know, Donald Trump in the past had made many unfounded allegations about voting in Detroit, which is where Wayne County is, saying that dead voters had been voting. None of that was true. Michigan was about to announce its results, and these two canvassers did try to rescind their certification, but it was too late. Michigan was declared for Joe Biden. Michigan was critical for Joe Biden's election win. And this effort, this phone call, seems to be another effort by the former president to stop that fact from becoming reality.
So we know there are a lot of ongoing efforts to hold President Trump and his political allies accountable for their efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. How does this episode fit into those larger efforts?
This effort, this phone call, is similar in a way to what we know came out of Georgia, where there's a state case against the former president in Fulton County, Georgia, where he called election officials there and said, can you guys find me 11,000 votes? We also know the federal case being brought against Donald Trump by special counsel Jack Smith charges him with four felonies. And in that indictment, it does cite Trump's use, alleged use of deceit to try to fool and persuade state elections officials to overturn elections. Wayne County is not in that indictment. We don't know if that's going to end up in evidence in that case. One former prosecutor that I talked to today did suggest that Ronna McDaniel could become a co-conspirator in the federal case, in one count of that case, if it could be proven that she knew that there was, in fact, no voter fraud, but yet was urging these elections officials to not certify, alleging that fraud existed. So still waiting to see on that.
And have we heard anything from Ronna McDaniel or President Trump on that phone call?
Yeah, no one disputed the contents of this call. A spokesman for former President Trump reiterated this ongoing lie that the election was rigged and stolen, and thus he had every reason to make a call to elections officials to try to stop that. Ronna McDaniel made a somewhat similar argument. She argued, we can show her quote here, she said, what I said publicly and repeatedly at the time is that there was ample evidence that warranted an audit of that vote. Again, at the risk of repeating myself, there was no evidence of election fraud in Michigan. No court case that was brought ever showed that that was the case. A state review run by Republicans in the state legislature found the same. Joe Biden won Michigan fair and square.
In this case, the efforts to overturn the 2020 election results didn't work. But if there was a similar pressure campaign in our upcoming presidential election, is our election system better prepared in any way to handle it?
This is an enormous ongoing concern. In Michigan, last year they passed a ballot measure that said canvassers, these two officials, can only certify an election based on the actual vote tally. So Michigan seems to have headed this off. But people who study elections worry that there are a lot of other states, Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, where similar rules are not being enacted and chicanery could occur.
While we have you, William, I know you've been covering all things related to legal matters around Mr. Trump. As we reported earlier, the Supreme Court just today declined to fast-track consideration of Mr. Trump's immunity claim related to charges brought against him for January 6th. What does that mean for that case?
This is a huge procedural win for the former president. As you mentioned, special counsel Jack Smith had asked the Supreme Court to basically leapfrog over an appeals court that was ruling on this motion, that the president had made this sweeping assertion that because he was president, he was immune from any alleged crimes he might have committed. Jack Smith said, I know there's an appeals court working on this, but I need the Supreme Court to look at this more quickly because this is an urgent matter for the nation. The Supreme Court said, we're not going to do it. The appeals court must rule. The reason this is a victory is for Trump is that that delays this process, which we know his legal team has wanted to do in all of these cases, delay them as long as possible. So the appeals court will rule. It may end up before the Supreme Court, but not right away.
William Brigham, thanks for unpacking it and making sense of it all. Appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Award-winning Ghazan poet Mosab Abu Toha lost his home, some of his friends and family members in the last 2 months. On November 19th, he himself was detained by Israeli forces on his way to the Rafah border as he tried to evacuate Gaza with his family and was released only after international outrage. He's now in Cairo with his wife and three kids and joined me earlier to talk about what he left behind and what the future holds for his homeland. Mosab, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Amna, for having me.
Take us back, if you can, to November 19th. Your son is an American citizen, so you and your family were trying to evacuate, heading down to the Rafah border. You were stopped by Israeli forces. What did they tell you about why you were detained?
Well, I was taking the Salah ad-Din street, the street that should have been a safe passage for people to evacuate from the northern part of Gaza to the southern part of the Gaza Strip. And on the way, there was a line, and the Israeli soldiers, there was an Israeli soldier calling people by description. So when it came to me, he said the young man with a black backpack with a red-haired boy, put the boy down and drop all your things and come join the line. There were about six snipers aiming at me. So I put the boy down, I dropped everything, and then I joined the line of the people. And then I was undressed in front of a Jeep behind a wall. Everything was confiscated from me, including the passports. And then I was blindfolded and handcuffed. Later, I knew that I was taken to Beersheba, about 2 hours away from Gaza. And without knowing anything, without having the blindfolds or the handcuffs removed. So I spent personally about 50 hours without seeing anything, without being able to move my hands.
Mosab, you were taken, we know, to a detention center in southern Israel, as you say. You were kept there for 2 days. What was that treatment like? And at any point, did anyone say why you were being held?
No, they first accused me of being a Hamas activist. I was beaten very hard. I was slapped across the face. I asked them if they have any proof, and he slapped me across the face. He said, "You give me proof that you are not Hamas." Then they didn't have any evidence. I asked them if they have a photograph, a video, a satellite image, anything that shows that what they are saying is correct. But it turned out to be that they were just taking me. And they knew who I was because my son is an American citizen and we are his family. So the names that were listed on the Rafah border crossing were cleared by the Israelis. They were just taking me to just treat me as bad as they could.
Mosab, were you alone during this whole time?
No. So when I was taken, there was in the line before we were undressed, etc., there were about at least 70 to 100 people. And then when we were taken to Beersheba, in that detention center, there were about 116 people. And then the next day, on Monday, I heard that there were new people, and the soldiers next door were making fun of the detainees. They were asking them to repeat Arabic children's songs. My wife told me that she used my phone, which she kept with her. She used my phone to contact my friends from CNN, friends from The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The New York Times. Every one of them wrote about my kidnap, and they asked for my safe release. And I would like here to thank everyone who helped me get out as soon as possible. And I ask everyone in the world to work very hard to get everyone out.
Mosab, we are speaking today as the home you left behind is virtually unrecognizable. And it's now at the grim milestone of over 20,000 people killed. What is it like for you to hear that number?
I can't believe what I see. I can't believe what I hear. So I'm now here in Cairo, unable to do anything to protect my family. And the fact that I was unable to do anything while I was in Gaza, and now I'm also again helpless to do anything to help and support my family in Gaza is very, very devastating. It's really very hard. With each step I took outside of Gaza, I knew that I was kilometers away from my family in Gaza.
I know you've lost dear friends and neighbors in this war so far. You posted a video of you reading part of a poem by one of those friends, a man named Rafat Al-Arir, a very famous poet and essayist. The poem is called If I Must Die. Here's a clip of you reading part of that poem.
If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.
So, Masab, Gaza storytellers are among those who are dying, poets and essayists and photographers and journalists. What's the impact of that?
Well, the impact that Israel wants to see is that no one talks about Gaza. Neither they are Gazans or international journalists. They want to kill people in Gaza, and they don't want the people to describe what happened. So they want just to bury the story and bury the people with it, which is, I think, the worst crime that could happen in history.
As you know, Israeli officials, and I have to say Israelis I've spoken with, say they cannot go back to the way life was before October 7th, having lived through those October 7th Hamas attacks, and they want to see Hamas gone. How does this end? What do you see ahead?
I think they can be true about saying that, but I would like to say to them and to the whole world that we have been unable to live at all. I mean, in Gaza, in the West Bank, Palestinians in the diaspora, they have been unable to live at all. We need to live a decent life, just like the one they are trying to have after killing us.
I know when you left, you were fleeing with really just what you could carry. And I wonder what it is you brought with you.
Well, I brought my wife with me, my three children, and a copy of my poetry collection. Only one copy. I lost every book that I was trying to compile on my bookshelves. Every time I traveled to the United States, I went there three times. Every time I went, I came back to Gaza with dozens of English books, especially ones signed by author friends. But now, when I got out of Gaza, I only had one copy of my book, which was published last year in San Francisco. And I only got out only with my clothes.
You're in Cairo now. What's next for you and your family? Where will you go?
Well, I have three options. One is going to the United States, which is something that I'm not willing to do right now because my family and also my wife's family are still in mortal danger. Any moment we can hear about something bad from them. Just like I learned today about the death of a very close friend of mine who used to be a farmer and a very excellent soccer player. The second option is he being here in Cairo for a job opportunity. And the third one, which I hope will happen soon, is returning to Gaza and reunite with my family. And hopefully we are not going to miss any one of them.
Masab Abu Toha joining us tonight from Cairo. Masab, thank you so much for your time. We're thinking about you and your family. Please stay safe.
Thank you so much for having me.
This year, the Transportation Security Administration says it screened a record number of passengers. And if the past is any guide, we'll handle millions of bags this holiday season. But a small fraction of them will go missing and unclaimed. Where do all those lost bags end up? Stephanie Tsai has that story.
Stuffed bunnies, fancy suits, and pink platform pumps. Welcome to the country's only retailer of lost baggage. Just off the road in the small city of Scottsboro, Alabama, the unclaimed baggage store has everything anyone would need, except almost all of this once belonged to someone else.
I love to see the items that come from all over the world. Some of the musical instruments are just amazing.
Jennifer Krittner has been working here for 26 years. She encourages shoppers to check out the store's museum, where some of the more eccentric items found in baggage are displayed.
An autographed Michael Jordan basketball is also among my favorite. I'm a huge basketball fan, so that stands out in my mind.
She says almost all checked bags, 99.5%, end up back with their owners after the flight. But some bags don't. After airlines launch a three-month search to reconnect the owner to their lost bag, the store steps in to purchase that fraction of a percent of bags that are orphaned.
our team of openers, that's what we call them, they open the suitcases and they really mine and explore those bags for treasures. These items, they're lost and they're unclaimed, and we need to figure out, can we resell this item? Do we need to recycle this item? Or is this an item that can be donated?
Nashville resident Sheila Allen has been shopping here for over 20 years. She says the discount prices keep her driving back.
It amazes me the things people put in their suitcases for checked luggage. Like this diamond ring that I have on. It's a heart-shaped diamond ring. It's a cluster of stones. A year or so ago, I bought a pair of sandals that had never been worn. I paid $20 for them, and when I looked the brand up online, they started at $120.
What our guests have in common is they love the thrill of the hunt. I mean, you never know what you're going to find.
Brian Owens is the owner and CEO of Unclaimed Baggage. In 1970, his father Doyle started the company, borrowing a pickup truck to transport his first load of unclaimed bags.
Our inventory, I've always thought about it like an archaeological dig. The bags and the lost and found items that we're seeing now are different in many ways than we saw, say, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. We have seen more bags come through our facility in the last couple of years than we ever have seen in the company history.
Last year, some 26 million pieces of luggage were lost, delayed or damaged, the highest number in a decade.
People still kind of reeling from COVID, staff shortages, a lot of expertise lost in the industry. We've seen a surge in the mishandled baggage rate.
Nicole Hogg is the director of baggage at aviation data company CETA. She says after high loss luggage rates the last few years, new data shows signs of recovery.
What airlines are doing is investing in tracking devices, which gives full visibility of the bag throughout the whole journey from the time that the bag's checked in to when it arrives and is in the hands of the customer or the passenger. You can track your pizza, you can track your Amazon delivery. And you know, customers have put a lot of pressure on the airlines and the industry to be able to have that visibility available.
Still, for those passengers that can't find their bags, even temporarily, the feeling of dread doesn't easily subside.
I've never seen so many suitcases in my life. They were just everywhere.
Last year, Tampa-based school teacher Brittany Lubier-Vervish's Southwest flight was canceled. While at the Tampa International Airport looking for her own missing suitcase, she decided to help others find theirs. Brittany texted around 70 people after finding their phone numbers on luggage bag tags, an act of service that got her anointed online, the Luggage Angel. On the receiving end of one of those messages was Tara Meadowcroft, a Missouri-based librarian.
I get this text message and I'm like, that's weird. I was just staring at it like, who is this? And so I texted back, but I was like, I'm very thankful for this. Here's a gift card. Because I was like freaking out.
I could have been, you know, scrolling through my phone the whole time that I was waiting there, but instead I wanted to do something productive and helpful. Travel is so stressful for so many people. So I did what I could to help.
Now, a year later, Brittany has some advice for the frequent traveler.
The easiest thing really is to have something like one of these little, you know, Velcro things that goes on your handle. You can get these straps, like this is just a plain strap, and you can have that embroidered or printed with your name. That was the lesson I learned, is clearly mark your bag.
Back in Scottsboro, Alabama, Sheila Allen is still shopping the items others have left behind. She has this travel advice.
I make sure when I travel, not only do I have tags on the outside of my suitcase, but I took tags on the inside of my suitcase as to where I'm going, where I can be contacted. So, I don't want to find my stuff here, you know.
She says if she ever loses a bag, she'd come right back here looking for it. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
an overwhelmed immigration system, a court ruling to keep Donald Trump off the ballot, and new details about his efforts to overturn the last election. To discuss it all, we turn now to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Good to see you both.
See you.
So we are seeing record daily encounters at the U.S. southern border once again. Senate went home without a deal. Border policy wrapped up with foreign aid funding. In the meantime, immigration as an issue, as a concern for Americans, has been rising. In some recent polling by Gallup, you see when people are asked what they think the most important problem the country is facing right now, the top one is government and poor leadership at 19%. Immigration is second at 15%, followed by the economy and inflation. Jonathan, the negotiators from the Senate who went home still have a chance to continue talking. Do you see them getting anything done?
In the spirit of Christmas, I want to say yes. But by the time they get something done, Christmas will have come and gone. And so, look, this much I know, they are trying. They are trying very hard. This much I also know. If they do indeed come up with a deal, it's going to be a deal that folks on the far right are going to hate because it doesn't go far enough from their perspective. And those on the left and within the Democratic Party, their hair is going to be on fire because it probably will go too far. But because it is attached to aid to Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan, the imperative to getting this done is so high that I think the negotiators are going to come up with a bill that is going to require a lot of people on both sides of the aisle to swallow a bitter pill if they want to get this done.
You agree with that?
Yeah, I think we're closer to some sort of bipartisan immigration bill than we've been since the Bush administration. Just a lot of people have a lot they need from this bill. The Biden administration is now just way behind in immigration. The Biden was, you know, slightly behind in immigration in 2020. Now he's like 30 points behind. Among immigrants themselves, people who personally came over to this country, Biden had a 20-point lead among immigrants now. Now it's even with Trump. And so the political pressure is just awesome. And then you look at Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell, Kyrsten Sinema. Everyone is sort of saying the right things. And of course, the details are the details, the immigration issue being what it is. But I just think so many different constituencies get something out of this that I think it's, I don't know if more likely than not, but more than we've seen in decades.
The cynical view here is the longer it's a problem, the more Republicans can leverage it and say it's Biden's problem and not want to fix it. Do you see any truth to that?
Yeah. Well, obviously, there's some truth to having an issue. But I think for Kyrsten Sinema, people like that, if you look at the individual senators or the individual House members, and you look at how people are reacting on the border, where they go to the grocery store and there's no food because they've been swamped, they can't get into the ER. Like, people are having real difficulties on the border in these towns that are overwhelmed. To me, those people are not looking for an issue. Those are looking for some help.
And I agree with you on that. But let's talk about even more cynical view, and that is Republican governors sending migrants from their states to northern cities, to cities that are run by Democratic mayors, and thus using immigrants and using human beings for political purposes, using them as pawns in their political games. And I think that's also why we see concern about immigration rising up to the top, including in places like New York City, which, you know, Republicans like to deride it as, well, you're a sanctuary city, well, you should take care of this. But in order for those things to work, things need to work at the border. And so this is a problem that is not one of President Biden's making. To your point, we haven't been this close to an immigration deal since President George W. Bush, the Republican, but this is something that has bedeviled both Republican and Democratic presidents simply because the incentives have not really been there to do anything about it.
And we cannot say enough, nothing changes substantially at the border until Congress acts. We have to underscore that, too. Meanwhile, all of these forces have allowed former President Trump to really double down on a lot of the anti-immigrant messaging. He has been he's been echoing Nazi propaganda by repeatedly saying immigrants are, quote, poisoning the blood of our country. We've got just over 3 weeks to go before the Iowa caucuses, and I need to point out that that language is actually resonating among likely GOP caucus goers. Take a look at this latest poll from the Des Moines Register and NBC in Iowa. They found 42% say those comments actually make them more likely to vote for former President Trump. Jonathan, what do you make of that?
I'm not surprised by that at all. It takes me back to the 2016 campaign, when there were a lot of stories that quoted people who went to his rallies. Why do you like Donald Trump? He says what we're all thinking. He says what I can't say. And it left me to wonder, well, what can't you say? He's called Mexicans rapists. He's called for a Muslim ban. This was during his campaign. Now, he was president for 4 years. So we know what his thinking is. And in these rallies where he talks about immigrants, he talking about poisoning the blood of our country, and he spells out they're coming from Africa, they're coming from Asia, they're coming from South America. What he doesn't say is they're coming from Europe. For him, immigrants are people who come from anywhere that's basically black or brown. And let's not forget what he said when he was president of the United States, how he derided immigrants from quote unquote S-hole countries. So we know what his viewpoint is. And so the fact that he is using this Hitler-esque language, we should take that very seriously. He's saying it over and over and over again. And it is terrible for political discourse. It is terrible for a country that is, you know, built by immigrants and enslaved labor.
David.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the comments were abhorrent and horrible. And Donald Trump has a talent for tapping into some of the darker underground rivers of American history. America first, nativism, know-nothingism, and this is an example. But we shouldn't ignore the fact, this statistic I said a couple minutes ago, which is that his support among immigrants themselves is surging. And so there's an actual issue here. And so in my view, anytime he talks about immigrants, he's probably gonna get, you're gonna get that 42% number. And then you got to remember 42% at least of Iowan Republican caucus goers are Trump supporters. So they're going to be pro-Trump no matter what when a reporter comes up. So, A, I think it's abhorrent, but we shouldn't reduce the whole issue to those abhorrent comments, those Nazi-like comments, that there actually is a core problem here that people are really resonating with.
I do want to get you both to weigh in on the issue out of Colorado as well, the Supreme Court there weighing in and basically saying Mr. Trump is not eligible to appear on their primary ballot, citing the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment. We know there's similar legal efforts underway in a number of states, so this is likely headed for the Supreme Court. But Jonathan, is this an issue that you think the courts should be deciding or the voters?
Yes. yes, in the short term, yes, I think this is an issue that the voters should decide because, one, the guy is, at least right now, leading in the polls. He is on his way quite possibly to become the next Republican nominee, and we're less than a year out, so the voters should have a say in this. At the same time, I say yes, that the courts should have a say because this is a question that has not been tested yet. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, even though the framers foresaw a Trump-like character coming, at least trying to come into power in American politics, that person has never tested the system the way Donald Trump has. The system has never been required to answer the question until now. And so I think just for the good of the country, let's have this conversation. These two things can happen at the same time.
You agree with that, David?
No.
No. What should happen?
Yeah, well, why is Donald Trump, why did he become president? Why are there populist movements across every Western country? It's because a lot of people in a lot of these countries, me included, think a highly educated cohort of, in this case, Americans, have created a hereditary meritocratic class. They have a lot of education. They now have a lot of cultural power. They control the media. They control the universities. They increasingly control the courts. And a lot of Americans say they have too much power. We're going to be populist. We're going to have an uprising. And then you have a series of judges with their Ivy League law degrees who come in and say, sorry, we're taking your guy off the ballot. That would explode this country. And in my view, explode it under the most dubious possible circumstances. For kicking him off for the Insurrection Act? Has he been convicted of offending the Insurrection Act? Has he been even charged with violating the Insurrection Act? No. And so to me, it would look like, and I think would be, just an elite power grab to deny people their democratic rights. I assume the Supreme Court will throw this out anyway, but that's my view.
And we should point out there's divergence among opinions, even for those who believe that he should not be president, is unfit to be president. So I'm sure it's something we're going to continue to cover. You have a quick point to make? Yes, please.
The quick point. Let's remember that the Colorado case has been brought by Republicans. Just make that
clear. Worth noting. Thank you for that. Look,
We are heading into Christmas weekend, and you both dig into some of the toughest issues of our time, which we so appreciate every week. But it is the season of peace, goodwill towards men and women, also the season of hope. I need to ask you both, what is it that gives you hope in this moment?
Oh, I was going to go to David first, but I've been like, no, for me, and I mean this in all sincerity, the American electorate give me hope. I know that there's some folks who might not agree with that, but the American electorate in 2022 during the midterm elections, they showed us that they are nuanced and sophisticated and can walk and chew gum at the same time. They might not like the economy, but they don't like what Republicans had in store for the country, and they blunted the red wave. It is my sincere hope that the American electorate, 1 year from now, will have saved American democracy, will have saved the idea of democracy for the rest of the world. That is my hope.
David.
Candy canes, dancing Santas, you know, the dancing Santa in the Target. How could you not be hopeful? Well, you got like Santa swinging their hips around. So I'm just filled with ecstatic exuberance.
I did not think this was going to end with you imitating a dancing Santa. For that, I am grateful. David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Over the holidays, you might have some time to catch up on new films at home or to venture out to the theaters. To help guide us on the best ones to add to your list, Jeffrey Brown speaks to two film critics on their top picks of the year. It's for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Union strikes caused delays and other bumps in the road in Hollywood this year, but some films still stuck out from the crowd. To tell us about this year's best films, I'm joined by Justin Chang, film critic of the Los Angeles Times, and Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Nice to see you both. Justin, why don't I start with you? Why don't you give us a couple of your favorites?
Yeah, hi, Jeff. My favorite movie of the year really snuck up on me. It's called All of Us Strangers. And it's the latest from the English writer-director Andrew Hay. It tells the story of a lonely screenwriter who's played in a quietly gut-wrenching performance by Andrew Scott.
Yeah, are you ready? I'm gonna press it.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, Merry Christmas. Here you go.
Merry Christmas.
I don't want to say too much about it. It's a gay love story. It's a drama about parent-child reconciliation. And it's also, and this is not a spoiler, it's a ghost story. I haven't seen a more intimate movie this year. What makes it work, I think, is that it's really hauntingly ambiguous on one hand, but it's completely emotionally direct and satisfying on the other. And it features what is, for me, the acting ensemble of the year, with not only Andrew Scott, but also Paul Mescal, Claire Foy, and Jamie Bell. A very different movie that I also loved is The Zone of Interest, which is Jonathan Glazer's chilling and searing drama about a Nazi commandant and his family living next door to Auschwitz. This is a movie I hesitate to describe as a Holocaust drama because it so completely subverts what we've been conditioned to expect about Holocaust dramas. It is very much about the banality of evil, but the movie itself is never banal. And it's the opposite of holiday cheer this season, but it is a movie that I hope audiences will embrace the challenge of, because I think it's rewarding to watch.
All right, so Linda Holmes, do you have any cheer for us? Those were two independent and pretty heavy films. What's on your list?
I did love a lot of heavy films this year, but I'm also happy to provide a couple that have maybe a little more cheer. Mm-hmm. I am one of the many people who enjoyed Barbie. I very much admired all the crafts that were on display in that film, the production design, the scoring, the costuming, all of that stuff I thought was wonderful. And I think the story in the end just was much more interesting. Greta Gerwig in writing and directing that just did much more with it than maybe people expected. And another
and
one-
clearly struck a chord.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, theatrical distribution still needs some big hits. Mm-hmm. That's still a really good thing for theaters. And I was really happy to see that happen. Another one I would mention is The Holdovers, which is from Alexander Payne. And it's about these three people who are stuck over the holiday break in a school. And it is Paul Giamatti as this very grumpy teacher. Mm-hmm. And then one of the kids that is in his class, and then the woman played by Devine Joy Randolph, who plays the woman who runs the food service. And they all get stuck there. I think it's a beautiful movie. It's very generous to its characters. And to me, it's warm without being cloying. That was how I responded to it.
You know, Justin, I was just thinking about Barbie, getting back to this big and small and that moment of Barbie. And I think you had Oppenheimer on as one of your favorites from the year. That moment of Barbie and Oppenheimer, was that a, how does it feel now? Was it a one-off? Did it have a lasting effect?
It's hard to say. I mean, it did feel like one of those unpredictable and perhaps unrepeatable phenomena. I remember going into a theater, not even to see Barbie or Oppenheimer, both of which I enjoyed very much in different ways. I went to see another movie and just seeing theaters like crowded on a Monday night. And I think the lessons of both these movies is that personal vision and big budget blockbuster filmmaking can and should merge together in a way that they so rarely do. My concern about it is that it was so heartening to see two filmmakers that I respect as much as Greta Gerwig and Christopher Nolan succeed in this way. My fear is that it just contributes to the eventization of movies. You know, I love event movies. I love being enthralled with an audience to a really big, glorious vision. But as a film critic, I'm concerned with the audience going to movies on a regular basis to make it a regular part of their entertainment diet rather than just an exception. But what a glorious exception it was.
You want to give us another one that fits any category you like? I mean, what are you telling people at this time of year that they should see?
I cannot resist bringing up one that I really liked that I know Justin didn't like at all, because I think sometimes that's the most interesting, which is Saltburn, which is this very extravagantly vulgar, loopy thriller that was made by Emerald Fennell, who made Promising Young Woman a couple years ago.
My parents, they've got problems.
What kind of, what do you mean problems?
I don't think I'll ever go home again.
Well, why don't you come home with me?
Very divisive movie. I knew walking out of the theater how divisive it was. And I've actually really enjoyed talking to people about it. I've heard a lot of smart people who can't stand it and really smart people who thought it was terrific. It's my favorite thing that happens is when people have smart conversations about divisive things.
Okay, well, Justin, you can either push back on that or maybe go positive and come up with another one that divided people but you liked.
In a spirit of holiday charity, I will say that while I did not like Saltburn, as Linda says, I do think that Rosamund Pike gives one of the great comic performances of the year in it. And Jacob Elordi, who's also great in Sofia Coppola's Priscilla, really does terrific work in Saltburn as well. So,
That's very generous, very generous.
You're welcome. Another favorite of mine to branch into animation is The Boy and the Heron, which is the latest and maybe the last, although we've heard that before, from the 82-year-old Japanese anime master Hayao Miyazaki. If you like Spirited Away and Princess Mononoke and Howl's Moving Castle and other Miyazaki films, it's a safe bet you will like this one too. It's a gorgeously drawn and surreal and inventive piece of animation. But what makes it so moving is it's also very much the story of an older man, perhaps Miyazaki himself, looking back at a younger version of himself and asking questions like, how do we reconcile the pain of the real world and the escapism of fantasy? It's a beautiful film, and I think a profound one, too.
And just in our last minute, Linda Holmes, it's hard to talk about this year without, of course, thinking about the strike. Mm-hmm. Do you see any impact now, or are you looking for it to come, or where has that left things?
You'll see some films that are delayed. There are some that are already being delayed, so it's going to take a while for the schedule to kind of reset. Mm-hmm. But I was so heartened by the fact that, you know, we've mentioned just a handful of movies here, but there are so many that were great this year that are still coming out. American Fiction is great. I Like the Iron Claw, which is about to come out.
Justin, brief last word.
I am just heartened by the fact that as devastating as the strike was, you know, I think writers and actors are happy to return to work, and I think they've seen that the power that solidarity can accomplish and that they can and should be remunerated in accordance with their work. I mean, they make this business run. And so it's just a shame that it took the devastating losses and just pain of the strike in order to accomplish that. But hopefully the season will be a good one for all of them.
All right. Justin Chang of the Los Angeles Times, Linda Holmes of NPR Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
You for having me.
We
We close tonight's program, heading into Christmas weekend, with a NewsHour tradition. Each year, the Pentagon's Defense Visual Information Distribution Service, or DVIDS, produces a holiday song with members of the military singing. Tonight, we have O Come All Ye Faithful with a bit of a twist. How's that for holiday spirit? Well, ever wonder what our favorite holiday traditions are here at the NewsHour? You can find out by going to our TikTok account. My colleagues and I weigh in on everything from caroling to fruitcake. And be sure to tune in to Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight right here on PBS. Jeffrey Goldberg and his panel discuss the Colorado Supreme Court decision to leave Trump off the ballot and what 2024 could bring. And tomorrow on PBS News Weekend, the promise shown by one transatlantic flight that could help the aviation industry lower emissions. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.